So I said last week that my wife Lisa asked about what Judge Felix Katina was doing, and she was not the only one interested in what Judge Katina was doing.
There were so many questions about what he's up to right now.
Can he get outside help sifting through all of this information, more than 800 pages of transcripts of everything that was said in court, all of the evidence that was presented, these videos, lots of stuff.
So here is what I was able to gather. I talked to a retired judge. I talked to a couple attorneys. Basically, Judge Katina is on his own on this. He is allowed to use his law clerk. He possibly could even, if he was really in a pinch, talk with other judges. But basically, Judge Katina is sifting through those transcripts that Lauren talked about, and he's reading through what was presented in the case, and he's going to make a verdict. And the retired judge I spoke to did think that he was going to issue a written decision. Well, that he would read from a written decision explaining his reasoning for saying guilty or not guilty.
And then again, a lot of people that I talked to, lawyers, journalists, said they didn't think he would, that this decision isn't actually going to break new legal ground. So there's really nothing to explain.
But what we do know is that on Thursday, at the end of the trial day, Mary Curran, the court clerk, came by and verified our emails and was making sure she had everybody in the media's emails. And she is going to let everybody know when the date is of the verdict. And so we'll know that in advance, and we'll be able to be report on it. We don't have to sort of case out the courthouse all day. So we do have lots of answers to many of your questions coming up.
DNA and fingerprints, oh my.
Who was it in the second story window?
And exactly who is the prosecutor on this case?
I'm David Summerstein.
I'm Britt Hansen.
And I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
And you're listening to Day by Day, the Nick Hillary Trial podcast. We have, for the last 3 weeks, been covering Nick Hillary's murder trial. He is charged with second-degree murder in the 2011 death of 12-year-old Garrett Phillips in Potsdam. And the trial is over, and we asked you on Friday to send us all your questions. And holy cow, we got a lot of questions, lots of details.
Yeah, one by one in my email over the weekend. Ding, ding, ding. Another question. I was really surprised. So thank you so much for sending those in.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. We appreciate your general curiosity, too, which was clear. We got a lot of alternate theories of the crime that were sort of presented as questions. And sadly, we cannot get into those. We will leave those to future reporting and also your imaginations. But there are lots of really great questions about, you know, the kind of the meat of what was presented at trial. And that's what we want to talk about today.
Okay. And so let's get right to it. Let's start with the DNA. The DNA was not in the trial because Judge Felix Katina ruled it be excluded from the trial. First of all, Lauren, tell us what the DNA in question is.
So the DNA in question comes from a scraping from beneath Garrett's fingernails. And
one thing about the DNA itself is it is tiny, tiny, tiny.
Yeah, it's like between 4 and 8 trillionths of a gram of DNA. And this is really, really small. It's kind of pushing the bounds of what you would normally see in a DNA analysis. And it's in this area where the science starts to get a little like futzy, for lack of a better term. It can make it really hard to draw firm results. And over the years, there's been a lot of debate back and forth about that. So we know that in about like 2013, the New York State Crime Lab ran its normal tests, and they got this result that said that Nick Hillary could neither be included nor excluded from the profile that they got. And the crime lab went back and forth over the years on what that actually meant. One tech said the results aren't okay, we shouldn't really be using them. Another tech said, I think the results should stand exactly as they are. So after that, there was another round of testing through the software called True Allele. This is the thing that's supposed to eliminate some of the guesswork, eliminate the need for techs to be making decisions and offering opinions. It's supposed to tell you the likelihood that somebody contributed to a sample. And the guy who created that software said that he couldn't find anything that was a statistical support for Nick Hillary being the contributor of the DNA under Garrett's fingernails.
Then we come to the third DNA analysis, which is StarMix, which was created, co-created by this guy, John Buckleton from New Zealand. And relatively recently, in the last year, the prosecution asked him to do another analysis. And that's the question that Judge Felix Katina had to rule on about whether that third analysis could be used in this trial. So what Judge Katina ruled in this was, one, this new DNA test, this third DNA test, he ruled that the New York State Crime Lab hadn't been licensed yet to work with StarMix. And so the results couldn't be used in this trial. He also ruled that John Buckleton himself said that this one way of sort of analyzing or looking at this DNA called random match probability, that it was essentially within so tiny, so within the margin of error, I guess you could say, that it would be prejudicial to Nick Hillary to allow it to be used at trial. So some of that answers, like Jack emailed and said, you know, where was the DNA evidence found and why didn't they use it? Someone asked, why was the DNA test rejected? What was wrong with the test? Was Hillary's DNA found? We did get one more little piece of information here. We just got our hands on the prosecution's argument to the court to re-examine the previous decision that the DNA can't be used.
That got shut down by the judge, and so we went to trial without any DNA getting kicked in. But as this last-ditch argument, there was some testimony from John Buckleton, who's the guy who came up with the StarMix software. And what they provided to the court answered a question that we had and some of you guys had, which is, what did that test actually say? Was Nick Hillary in the DNA under Garrett Phillips' fingernails? And according to John Buckleton, who's the scientist who invented the test, he tells the judge in this filing, yeah, I think it does, because there are 11 alleles in this little tiny, tiny, tiny DNA sample that don't belong to Garrett Phillips and do match the DNA profile that we have for Nick Hillary. And we don't know how else to explain that. That should probably be evidence at trial.
Now, we don't know of what really 11 alleles means. Is that a lot of alleles or is that a little alleles? If you tested a whole bunch of other people's DNA, would they also have 11 alleles that would be in this? We don't know what to make of that 11 alleles because it never came up in the trial.
I think the one thing we do know is that other DNA experts have weighed in the course of all these hearings on DNA in this case, and they've said, man, I'm just not comfortable with this test being used in this way. I think we all need to like take a breather and distance ourselves from the results of this particular use of the test.
Okay, let's move on to fingerprints.
You all sent a lot of questions about who was tested against these four latent fingerprints in the window that the attacker and killer of Garrett Phillips was alleged to have jumped out of.
Really quickly, what latent fingerprints means is they basically lay tape on this area where they find these fingerprints and pull off the tape, and then they use that as sort of their mold, I guess you could say, to compare against the various fingerprints.
Exactly. So those four sets of latent fingerprints were tested against 40 people who were in and out of the apartment sort of that month during when the Phillips family lived there before Garrett was killed. Included in that was Nick Hillary, John Jones, Tandy, Garrett's mom, the apartment manager who took care of the space. And we know that none of those were a match for the latent fingerprints that were found.
And they've tried to continue to update that. If they've thought of more and more people that they could possibly test, they've tested those.
And so the state keeps this database of fingerprints. There are something like 8.4 million prints in it, and new ones are being added all the time, mostly from people getting arrested, but also if you apply for a government job, you get fingerprinted, and it goes into this database. And we know that like over the years, New York State has matched 32,000 latent fingerprints that they couldn't identify to this database. So as time goes by, these unidentified prints will ostensibly still be checked against these new prints coming in.
If Nick Hillary is found not guilty and they're still looking for a killer for Garrett Phillips, then these would be continued to be checked against all these databases and any other fingerprints that they can find later on. Yeah. There were also a bunch of questions about the person in the second story window, i.e. Andrew Carranza, who was a witness who testified for the prosecution. He was out in the parking lot changing the tire on his car the afternoon of the murder. And at one point, he heard a noise and he looked up to where it was coming from and he looked at that second story window and he said, I saw someone in the window sort of looking out. He even said he thought it was like a nosy neighbor is the word that he used to describe it. But he was never asked this huge question.
What did that person look like? And so a lot of you caught on to that. We talked about it in earlier episodes of the podcast. Doug, Sarah, and Jack, you sent in questions over email about this, sort of like, hey, could you just remind us what happened? So again, you know, Carranza didn't say anything about who that person was. The prosecution didn't ask. The defense didn't ask. And you also had some questions about, so if those folks didn't ask, what did the police statement say? And unfortunately, our answer for you is we haven't seen Carranza's police statement. We don't know if he said anything about that. But the one place that we did hear a little bit about that was from defense attorney Norman Siegel.
Yeah. So after one of these, you know, days in court, there was a press conference, and Siegel said there are a couple of different reasons why the prosecution chose not to ask that question. It could be that, you know, the answer didn't fit with their theory of the case. Now, that's really speculative. And obviously, the defense attorney is going to say that. But the other thing he said is sometimes you get a witness and they're really credible on certain points of their testimony. And then you get into other areas and you're not so sure. And it's also possible that, you know, his recollection changes over time. We have people forgetting things left and right throughout this trial because, again, it's been 5 years since the crime took place. So there are a couple of different reasons why the prosecution might have decided not to go there. And the defense team said, essentially, he wasn't our witness and it's not our job to ask a question like that of him.
And other lawyers that we spoke to said, hey, you never ask a question in a trial that you don't know the answer to. Let's get to the prosecution. And who was prosecuting this? Ginny asked a good question and said, I'm confused because the district attorney for this trial is listed in your news coverage as Mary Rain. The assistant prosecutor is William Fitzpatrick, which suggests that he's helping Mary Rain. Yet the opening statement, questioning of people called to testify, and the closing argument are all being done by the assistant. It seems like he's doing everything, not just assisting. Why is that? What role is Mary Rain playing in this trial? So first, Britt, you sort of analyzed exactly how many times William Fitzpatrick did the questioning and how many times Mary Rain did the questioning?
Yeah, I made a spreadsheet because I love the spreadsheets. And in the spreadsheet, there are a few little holes that we couldn't find in our notes and back on Twitter coverage. But in general, what we can see is sort of 3-1. Fitzpatrick was asking, doing the cross-examination. He did the opening statements, all of that stuff. We heard from Mary Rain 6 times, at least that, maybe a few more. But we heard from Fitzpatrick at least 18 times, plus opening and closing statements. So he really did, as far as courtroom proceedings, take the lead.
So you can see, we don't know what happened behind the scenes, of course, but we can say that in the trial, from what we saw, really, St. Lawrence County District Attorney Mary Rain played a minor role in the prosecution of this case.
And that was not the plan. So it is really, really rare for a district attorney to delegate responsibility the way that Mary Rain did throughout this trial. There is a provision in county law that allows you to call in for help from outside prosecutors. And apparently in his own career, William Fitzpatrick has done this before. I talked with Doug Dowdy, who's a crime and courts reporter for the Syracuse Post-Standard in Onondaga County. So he's been covering Fitzpatrick's career for the last couple of years. And there was an instance where Fitzpatrick needed help. He called in like 15 outside prosecutors to lend a hand. And that's totally fine. They're there in an advisory capacity. That was originally what Fitzpatrick was invited to do on this case, by the prosecutor who was in office when Garrett was first murdered back in 2011. Nicole Duvet contacted the State District Attorney Association and said, I need help trying to figure out if I should pursue charges against my main suspect. And Nicole Duvet lost her reelection bid to Mary Rain, who campaigned on this platform of finding justice for Garrett, because at this point the case had gone unsolved for a couple of years and people had some pretty big questions about why. As time wore on, Mary Rain asked Fitzpatrick to play a bigger and bigger role, examining what she was going to present to grand juries on the case, and then eventually taking the step of asking the county judge to appoint him an assisting prosecutor. And so where we wound up at trial, kind of unprecedented. You know, Doug is a pretty experienced criminal justice reporter, and he said you just don't see stuff like this very often.
One interesting sidebar to this was at one point, it was our understanding when we were reporting this a year ago maybe, that the biggest reason why Bill Fitzpatrick was being brought in was because he was a real expert in some of these DNA matters that we talked about at the top of the podcast. And then all of a sudden that stuff got thrown right out. And so then there he was. This was ostensibly the reason that he was brought in to be a real expert on that. And that stuff was, of course, absent from the trial.
So where this sort of leads me next, and we got a lot of questions from listeners, is in light of the Brady violation that happened during this trial, and that's the, for those of you who are just kind of joining us now, a Brady violation is when potentially exculpatory evidence is discovered by the prosecution and then not shared with the defense. And that happened in this trial. The judge said that happened in this trial, which is essentially saying the prosecution withheld evidence. So a lot of folks are wondering, and I think we may be wondering too, is there any consequence for Mary Rain, District Attorney Mary Rain, after this is over?
I spoke with a few legal experts and practitioners about this, and they said, you know, yes, there could be. This is stuff that could be introduced at any point, really, and by many different people. The judge himself can recommend an investigation into this. The defense can recommend an investigation, or outside bodies who represent the legal community in New York State can also recommend this. This is, you know, a sort of body of peers who, you know, have licenses to practice law in New York State, policing each other in a sense.
Yeah, and it hasn't been published, but we know that there's a criminal defense association in New York State that's taken an interest in this. I believe that some members of the defense team in this case are also members of that group. So that's kind of how they became aware, but they sent a letter to the New York Times saying what happened in this case is not acceptable. There should be repercussions. So that outside group is watching, and if they wanted, I think they could file a complaint as well.
Let's end with our only audio question. Bravo, bravo to Lee from Saranac Lake.
Gold stars for you, Lee.
Hi, this is Lee from Saranac Lake. I have two questions. First, if found not guilty, what are the next steps? Does Hillary's civil suit against the village of Potsdam move forward, or are there rumblings of a civil suit against Nick Hillary from the Garrett Phillips family? Second, if found guilty, what are the potential prison terms, and can the judge convict Hillary of a lesser crime like manslaughter? Thanks.
Okay, so thank you, Lee. Lots of questions within that question. Love the curiosity. So let's start by talking about the sentences. The sentence for second-degree murder, which is what Nick Hillary stood trial for this month, is 15 years to life in prison. And that's based on probably his prior criminal record in the state of New York, which we know is pretty much clean.
In terms of could the judge find him guilty of a lesser charge, the answer is probably not, because the prosecution made very clear that its case was based on premeditated murder, that Nick Hillary hunted and stalked Garrett, and that is a second-degree murder charge. And so that is what Judge Katina is being asked to rule on, not manslaughter.
So as far as we know, Nick Hillary's civil lawsuit is going to continue moving forward. The the lawyers for the village of Potsdam, named as defendants in the suit, recently moved to, you know, break open the seal so the documents in that case, you know, become public. And maybe the lawyers for the village will be open to talking to the press about it. We don't know yet. As far as whether the victim's family is weighing a civil suit against Nick Hillary, we haven't heard anything to that effect. The family has been pretty quiet since the trial started, and we wouldn't expect an answer on that maybe for a while.
So that's where we're going to leave it. We'd love to have more questions, news@ncpr.org. We will have more podcasts leading up to the verdict. And then, of course, we'll have a podcast once the verdict is delivered by Judge Felix Katina. Thank you very, very much for all of your comments. And we'll be back at you soon.